Please open your Bibles again to Matthew 20. I'll mention that this is still another sermon in the Red Print series I've been preaching since the beginning of the year. We've been looking at some of the actual words Jesus spoke. These are the words that are printed in red in some Bibles, especially earlier Bibles in the 20th century. These days we hear a lot of people telling us what Jesus believed and taught, but Bible-believing Christians know it's best to go right to his very words and see what we can learn from them. When I was 15 years old, in my sophomore year at the local high school in my hometown of Redfield, South Dakota, I got a part-time job after school at Sunshine Dairies, the milk bottling plant in town. At the end of the school year, the job went so well that my parents suggested that since I had only a few credits to go in my high school classes, maybe I would like to finish high school through an accredited correspondence course from a place called the American School in Chicago. So I did that, and the company sent me textbooks and examination books, and that's how I finished high school, my mom goading me to study all the way along. That meant that I could work full-time at the dairy, and that's what I did. This was a wonderful experience for me. I learned how to get to work on time, how to punch a time clock, how to do exactly what I was told and not goof off, how to wash milk bottling machine parts so they were absolutely sanitary, which has been a great help whenever I wash dishes. We have a dishwasher, electric dishwasher at home. But when I wash your dishes manually, you will never become ill from dishes which I have washed. I get the water as hot as possible. I even cranked up the water heater temperature a little bit, get that water as hot, too hot to put your hands in, but you lunge in, get a fork, and you scrub that fork. And so you will not get sick from eating anything that I have washed in that way. And of course, since I became a working man, I got a weekly paycheck. I think when I started as the youngest worker in the plant, I was probably making 75 cents an hour. This is before minimum wage. Minimum wage is actually $1.25 at that point. But I was making 75 cents an hour. And just from osmosis, I learned that it is not polite or proper to ask somebody what their hourly wage was. And if somebody asked me, I learned to adroitly evade the question. Now, looking back on it now, I realize this was kind of silly. I mean, I may have been making 75 cents, but Doug, the guy who was 3 or 4 years older than I was, who worked on the half-gallon milk carton machine next to me, probably got a grand total of 85 cents an hour. But even though there were just a few pennies difference between my wage and his wage and the wages of everyone else, we all guarded our own wage very, very carefully. And if rumors started going around that somebody who worked at the dairy, not quite as long as someone else, was making a slightly higher wage, the rest of us were puzzled and outraged. Imagine what it was like then as a working teen, I read Jesus' parable about the landowner, which we'll be talking about. I really had a hard time with this one. And if you don't yet know the story, you'll see why as we go through it. Because like all the other red print Jesus said in the gospel, this is an important story. And I think the only way we can make a real sense of it is to keep our eyes on the landowner. Because we need very greatly what this landowner will teach us. Let me show you what I mean. Let's start with verse 1 again. Matthew 20, verse 1. For the kingdom of heaven is like a landowner. Here's sermon point 1. What do we find out when we keep our eyes on the landowner? Number one, we find out that God owns land. God owns land. If you're reading from the New English Standard or the English Standard Version, it calls this man not the landowner, but the master of the house. And that's actually the literal Greek reading in the Greek. But all the other major versions call him a landowner, probably because the story features land, the land. So if the landowner represents God, that makes sense because God owns land. Psalm 24, verses 1 and 2. I'm going to quickly go read that one for you. Psalm 24, 1 and 2. The earth is the Lord's and all its fullness, the world and those who dwell therein. So it says God owns the world. This week I saw in the news a story about a British power company who was planning to put a wind farm on a strip of land on the east coast of England. Maybe you heard about this too. But as they were digging, they discovered what has turned out to be a sort of ancient road or trackway used by people way back to 2300 BC, if they have their timing right. This discovery has turned the wind farm project into a 16,000-acre archaeological site. Those doing the dig have found tools, arrowheads. There was a beautiful picture of a beautiful little flint arrowhead, very carefully carved, and even the skull of an extinct cow. There was a certain type of cow. They found the skull. It's a cow no longer in existence nowadays, but there it is. This means that God, who is represented by this landowner, owned that land as well. He created it. He also created those ancient people who walked along that trackway and left those tools and arrowheads behind them. By the way, once I put the sermon online, I put a link to that story, but you can find it by independent searching if you need to. Remember, Jesus said, the kingdom of heaven is like this landowner. Why is that important? It means that God isn't merely a faraway religious idea. A lot of people treat him that way, aside from using his name profanely. They scarcely seem to think about him at all, except to maybe unthinkingly blame him for bad things that happen. The fact that God owns this planet, Psalm says that he owns the cattle on a thousand hills. The fact that Jesus said that the Heavenly Father is interested in each one of us, so interested that if somebody asked him to, he could give them an accurate count of the number of hairs on that person's head at that time. The fact that God owns and is deeply interested in this planet and the people who live on it reminds me that God isn't simply an optional philosophy. I can choose if I happen to agree with it. God is too close, too real for that. He wants our companionship too badly for that. Read through John chapter 17 sometime, Jesus' prayer to his Father, and you'll see just how close they want to be to us. They want to be within us. I in me, you in me. God, Jesus repeats that. I in you, you in me. God in us. So what do I do with this? I need to get into the habit of remembering that God created the fireflies too. And thank you, Rishana, for that wonderful story. And therefore, God created and therefore owns my very body. He owns any resources I have, where I live, what I drive, where I work, what I get paid. Later in the story, when the vineyard workers go to work, they're working on land owned by the landowner, harvesting grapes owned by the landowner. And it's the same with you and me as we move out from this sanctuary and move into another week. We must be stewards of the resources God has given us. Now let's look at something else we can learn as we keep our eye on the landowner in Jesus' story, chapter 20, verse 1 again. For the kingdom of heaven is like a landowner who went out early in the morning to hire laborers for his vineyard. Are you watching the landowner carefully? If you're watching carefully, you see that he is not a rich playboy. He's not taking a cruise around the world in his yacht somewhere. He's not sitting in a grandstand somewhere cheering on his favorite horse in a horse race. He is not watching his favorite basketball team or whatever. No, this landowner is on the job just as vigorously as anybody who works with him. And as we see what he does in the next few verses, we'll discover the second truth we learn as we keep an eye on this landowner. Here comes sermon point two. Not only does God own land, but God has work for everyone. God has work for everyone. During camp meeting week, I sat in on what is probably the most practical and useful seminar I have attended in a long time, maybe ever. The class was called Becoming Skilled Comforters. It was one of the most popular classes that week. A couple of days I counted class members, and one day there were 26, and the other day there was 27 people. The teacher was Karen Nicola, and she got right to work teaching us that no matter who we are, no matter how much education or how little education we have, no matter what our personality type is, we can learn to be real comforters of people who are grieving a loss of some kind. She told us things not to say to grieving people, because these statements would only make things worse. She told us how important it was to listen to what the other person is really saying and not try to jump in with hints or how-to tips of our own. She told us one thing. She said, don't say, I know how you feel, because you don't know how somebody feels who has lost somebody. Even if you've lost a child and they've lost a child, you don't know how they feel. So just don't say that. Karen had us sit around little tables, four persons to a table. Nobody was allowed to sit by themselves at the back of the room just to observe, although some people at first tried to do this. She'd walk over to them and graciously urge them to fill up an empty space at one of the tables. And for at least half of each class session, she was not the one doing the talking. We were, to the other people at our table, and occasionally to the whole group when she asked for feedback. Karen Nicola believed exactly the way the landowner in Jesus' story believed. Watch what he does. Chapter 20, starting with verse 1 again. For the kingdom of heaven is like a landowner who went out early in the morning to hire laborers for his vineyard. Now, when he had agreed with the laborers for a denarius a day, a little coin that was worth one day's wages, he sent them into his vineyard. And he went out about the third hour and saw others standing idle in the marketplace. See, the way they numbered their hours was 6 o'clock in the morning was the first hour. And then the third hour would be 9. The sixth hour would be noon, and so on. And verse 3, and he went out about the third hour and saw others standing idle in the marketplace and said to them, you also go into the vineyard, and whatever is right I will give you. So they went. Again, he went out about the sixth and the ninth hour and did likewise. It gets to be 3 o'clock in the afternoon now. So the more I read this story, the more amazed I am. This landowner probably employed trusted servants he could send out to the vineyard to recruit, into the marketplace to recruit workers. But instead, this is important enough to him that he goes on these recruiting trips himself. Several times that day, the NIV translates the hours he went into the modern terminology I've mentioned. Landowner gets out early in the morning and then comes back at 9 o'clock to collect other workers, then at noon, then at 3 p.m. And in a moment, we'll see that he goes out one more time. So why is this so important? Why did Jesus want us to know about the kingdom of heaven and that heaven's landowner king? Well, for one thing, it's very clear that in the kingdom of heaven, there are no spectators. There are no observers. There's work to be done. And so the landowner comes out and continually recruits workers, because God has work for every one of us to do, no matter what physical condition we're in, no matter how unprepared we feel to work for him, no matter how battered and beaten by the world we have been, God has work for each of us to do. I know I've told this story before. When I was a kid, my mother would be working in our kitchen. The phone would ring, and on the other line would be a lady who had called just to vent her frustrations about her husband. And Mom would patiently stand there for an hour and a half sometimes, trying to stretch the coiled cord of the phone all the way over to the sink so that she could get something done while this lady talked. But Mom would patiently listen. The caller was hampering Mom's housework, sometimes immobilizing her. And with that heavy black phone receiver propped up by her shoulder, Mom was doing the work of the Lord. So what should I do now that I've been reminded that God has work for every one of us? One of the most helpful parts of that camp meeting comforting class was listening to other people at my table tell stories about how they had been comforted in inexpert ways, and how in some instances they themselves had been inexpert comforters to other people. In that class, we learned from each other almost as much as we learned from the teacher. I think you and I need to develop and refine our helping stance. The people who are in charge of our potlucks tell me that when they're shorthanded, other people often rush up to help them serve or clean up. At camp meeting last Saturday night, at the end of the final meeting in the big auditorium, one of the conference people mentioned over the microphone that an event would be happening the very next day in that auditorium, and so could everybody help load the chairs onto the chair carts. It was amazing to see everyone spring into action, and within just a few minutes, those 2,000 chairs were folded and stacked, and the floor was clean. That's what I mean by a helping stance. Our greeters in the foyer are great at this. They watch for people coming. They greet them. They hand them a bulletin. They show them where the appropriate classroom is, take their kids down to the divisions, and so on. And that's just one of many examples of helpers in this congregation. Christians understand that the heavenly landowner won't allow anyone to be a spectator. There is work for everybody, and everybody is needed, and you're the happiest when you're being a servant. And that means everybody. Watch what happens next, verse 6. And about this 11th hour, he went out and found others standing idle and said to them, "Why have you been standing here idle all day?" They said to him, "Because no one hired us." He said to them, "You also go into the vineyard, and whatever is right, you'll receive." Here comes sermon point 3. What do we see when we keep our eyes on the landowner in this parable? Not only does God own land, in other words, he owns everything. Not only does God have work for everyone, but God even hires the unhirable. God even hires the unhirable. Think about it. After the landowner had returned from his 9th hour, 3 p.m. recruiting trip, he could have said, "Well, that's it. The guys just have 3 hours to work. Let's just use all the people we have now. Call it good." But no, out he goes again at the 11th hour, which is 5 p.m., an hour before quitting time. He gets to that marketplace. What does he see? A bunch of guys who still have not been hired. Why haven't they been hired? We don't know. Were they there when the landowner showed up for his earlier recruiting trips? We don't know. Maybe not. Because each time he had come earlier in the day, he vigorously rounded up everyone who was willing to work. Maybe some of these final people had at first refused the idea of vineyard labor. As the day went on, nobody else had come along and hired them to do any other kind of work. So here they are, 5 o'clock, waiting for something to do, maybe getting desperate. And maybe some of them didn't look like good workers. Maybe they didn't think they were good workers. Maybe they had slept in that morning and come to the marketplace too late in the day. You'd think that at 5 p.m., the landowner would have paused and studied these strangers shrewdly. You think he might be saying to himself, "Okay, why are these guys still here? Are these really the type of people I need out there picking my grapes?" Instead, he gets really direct. "Well, you guys are standing around here doing nothing." They tell him, "Nobody's hired us." Here's a perfect opportunity for a vetting question like, "Why not?" But instead, the landowner hustles them out to the vineyard to get in maybe 45 minutes of work. God is in favor of full employment in the work he needs done. Here in the United States, full employment is considered to be when less than 4% of the workers are unemployed. That's full employment. But with God, full employment is when 100% of the people are involved in his cause. True, not everyone has the same talents or abilities. Can't all sing like Sabrina, play like Aaron, but we all have something to do for the kingdom of God. God knows what that is, and we need to pray that he shows us what it is, if he hasn't already. I think for a lot of you in this room, he has shown you what you can find joy in doing for him. Now, get ready for the most jolting and confusing part of this whole story. I can imagine Jesus in amusement watching the faces of his listeners as he tells them this final scene, verse 8. So when evening had come, the owner of the vineyard said to his steward, "Call the laborers and give them their wages, beginning with the last to the first." It's kind of unusual. Verse 9, and when those came who were hired about the 11th hour, each received a denarius, the one day's wage. But when the first came, they supposed that they would receive more, And they likewise received each a denarius. And when they had received it, they complained against the landowner, saying, these last men have worked only 1 hour, and you made them equal to us, who have borne the burden and the heat of the day? Can you see why I was so confused by this parable as a full-time teenage worker? If I worked 1 hour, I would get 75 cents. Whether I came in for the first hour or the last hour of the workday, I knew I would get 75 cents for it. Notice the landowner's good-natured explanation, verse 13. But he answered one of them and said, friend, I am doing you no wrong. Did you not agree with me for a denarius? Take what is yours, go your way. I wish to give this last man the same as you. Is it not lawful for me to do what I wish with my own things? Or is your eye evil because I am good? So the last, this is Jesus probably tying off the story. So the last will be first and the first last. For many are called, but few are chosen. So what do we see as we keep our eyes fixed on the landowner? We see that not only does God own land, not only does God have work for everyone, not only does God even hire the unhirable, but if we keep our eyes fixed on the landowner, we see that God exchanges my strict fairness for his staggeringly generous fairness. God exchanges my strict fairness for his staggeringly generous fairness. The Bible is full of stories about 11th hour people who frittered away a good part of their lives ignoring God or even opposing God. And when the heavenly landowner eventually tapped them on the shoulder in a way they couldn't ignore, and they went out into his vineyard, they became the most grateful of all. Toward the end of Luke chapter 7, Jesus said that the people who were forgiven the most love the most. When the apostle Paul was still Saul, he was a persecutor, but when Jesus met him in a blaze of heavenly glory and convinced him not to do that anymore, Paul was so grateful that he considered himself the chief of sinners, unworthy of God's love, and he spent the rest of his life introducing other people to that same love shown by that same God. That splendid, generous fairness. God exchanges my fairness for his fairness. My fairness, which is a good fairness for the way things are in this world right now, says that people get paid for the work they do. We're used to getting paid by the hour or paid by the piece, a wage calibrated to how long we work or how much we do. But in heaven, as we understand it, there won't be any wages. Why would there be wages? Down here, wages protect us from starvation and keep us sheltered. But in heaven, we will build houses and inhabit them and live there as long as we want to. We will plant fruit and eat it. In Jesus' story, the landowner gave each worker a fair day's wages, even though some didn't truly deserve it. You can say that heaven's denarius is eternal life and eternal security. Everyone who responds to God's call will be given exactly that same priceless privilege. And if that system seems deliriously ridiculous, so be it. That's the way heaven works. Both heaven and earth work on the merit system. They both do. Down here, we do a good job. Sometimes we're promoted. But in heaven, it's not our merit, but Jesus' merits that make us deserving of heaven. Another name for this idea is the gospel. For God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son, that whoever believes in him should not perish but have everlasting life. The only logical thing to do when presented with a gift like that is to say yes to it. Have you done that? Have you not done it yet? Either way, raise your hand if you'd like to accept Jesus' life and death for you. Would you like to raise your hand right now?